morning. Members of the court, to please the court, my name is Matthew Taylor on behalf of Appellant Wright Medical. I'm here with my colleague Shannon Sutherland. If I may, with the permission of the court, the first issue that I'd like to talk about is this breach of contract. And this breach of contract is not only Sarah Bio's breach of contract, but it's our defense to that breach, and it's our counterclaim for breach. And three things were important on pursuant to the asset purchase agreement on that point. Transfer of the know-how in this technology to Wright Medical, the training of the Wright Medical employees, and the running of these three test lots using the work instructions, which were attached to the agreement, to achieve verification. After the closing, Sarah Bio revealed in Mr. Cassidy's letter, he formalized that notification, that our work instructions are now meaningless because an event has occurred, that event being the unavailability of some raw materials, the key raw materials. He said, at that point, they could not deliver unless Wright Medical agreed to let them continue. And that's set forth, Mr. Cassidy agrees, at page appendix 952 in his letter, that he said, pursuant to our telephone conversation, I advise you of the event, you agreed to allow us to change, i.e. redline, the work instructions. That is the key event here. We did allow them to continue working and work on these work instructions pursuant to misinformation. That misinformation was critical here. In that letter, he said, this event occurred and we did not know about this prior to the closing. He goes on to say, well, that is the key, and we would have... It does, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. Here's why it's the key here. They were at sea after this, when they could not get the raw material. They did not know how to do it. And Sarah Bio, who we had contracted with, their job was to teach us how to do it, reach verification, then we were off to the races and try to go to market. We could not do it ourselves. We weren't the experts. We relied on them to train us with this know-how. They kept themselves in the door by saying, this is not a big deal. He says, happens all the time in the ceramics industry. We were prevented, Your Honor, from cross-examining this man on this alleged modification. We found out in discovery that prior to the closing, that they were well aware of this unavailability. Your Honor, in all due respect, there was no mixed evidence. It was undisputed. No, it was uniform that they stated to us, Dr. Coe says, I knew about it. The man from England told me prior to closing. He writes an email. This is prior to closing. Writes an email to Cassidy. This is my worst nightmare. Am I going to have to wash off 3 years of effort? They knew going into it. Sarah Bio knew that they had to tell us that, or else we would have said, "Are you kidding me?" After that, if they had just been honest with us and said, "You know, this is a major event." Our head ceramicist Co. says, this is my worst nightmare, and it's going to be a major effort, We would have stopped the presses. That's the prejudice. That may be true, Your Honor, that it doesn't say there's a guarantee for a source. However, the work instructions are part of the contract. The work instructions identify the Sarah Bio starting powder. The point is, they could not ever even attempt verification without a new starting powder, and they told us that they just learned about it, it's not a big deal, let us try to do this. We have to modify these work instructions.
Okay.
First of all, Your Honor, we would have had a year having worked with this powder, having the know-how transferred. They would have satisfied the contract, quite frankly, if there, say, there was only a year's supply of the old starting powder, which was unavailable prior to contract, which they didn't tell us about. They would have reached verification. We would have had to pay them the $1.5 million. The fact remains is that they could not reach verification with the work instructions that were part of the contract. They were meaningless. It was worthless to us. They appease us by saying we need to modify this deal, these work instructions, and it's not a big deal. We just learned about it. This happens all the time in the ceramics industry. That's the prejudice. Well, both, Your Honor, because Your Honor, they can't run away from the fact that prior to the contract, and this would have been part of what we would have tried to get in, but for the bright blue line, we would have said, remember what you told to us, that this, there are two sources for it, that it's commercially available. We had asked those questions. Now, granted, that was pre-contract, and we didn't know the source of the powder. They wouldn't tell us the source, but they made those representations so that post-contract, when they come to us, they had to say that. They had to say, we just learned about this. And the key combined facts are, they say, the process adjustments of this type are commonly employed in the ceramics industry. Remember, they're the ceramics experts. We were not. We were learning from them. Then we would have reached verification. Then we would have been off to the races. The problem is, Judge, the problem is that those two misrepresentations, we could not question this man on. We couldn't say, Mr. Cassidy, let me ask you a question. Why did you tell us? Why were you so, make such a point about that you didn't know it before for the contract? At the time, Your Honor, that's exactly what we did. We did not know about their knowledge prior to the contract. We did not know that Inco thought it was his worst nightmare and he might have to wash off 3 years of experience. We observed them down in our place and we worked with them. We, in fact, allowed them. We agreed, arguably, to allow them to rework these work instructions. That's exactly the point. And we worked with them for 3 months and we could observe that they were at sea, that there was some confusion, that they were producing these what they called pre-verification, which is not a term in the main contract, which was coined in these letters, and we said, wait a second, you're not getting there. You told us this was no big deal. You told us this was common in the industry, and we're watching you fail, fail, fail. You can't get there. Now, had we been able to cross-examine them at trial, we could have colored this fact that they were at sea on our time, basically performing science experiments on our plant, trying to just get pre-verification lots. That is where the prejudice was. We would have been able to say to Mr. Cassidy, Inco said he told you a week or so prior to the closing that it was his worst nightmare. What are we going to do? Wright Medical would have loved to have known that. We would have never agreed to let them rework this and perform science experiments. We bought a system and a process, set work instructions. That was what the contract was for. Plasma bias hole was the source of the starting powder in England. Your Honor, that was well after the fact. They, Wright Medical did not certify a new powder with its own ingenuity until June and July of the next year, of 2003. When we told Cerebio that their efforts are over, they have not done this in a commercially reasonable time, you're not making progress, you have not reached verification, your pre-verification runs all fail, we're going to do this ourselves. We can't wait any longer for you all. We tried to work with you, and we did. We tried through September and October to let them rework whatever they tried to rework based on their representation that this was not going to be a big deal, that they just learned about this. Without the jury ever hearing this struggle that was going on all through June and July prior to the contract with Inco of Cerebio and this vendor in England, where the vendor said, I can't give you what you want. And they never tell us that. So after the contract, Cassidy knows I have to get Wright Medical's agreement to change the work instructions, which are in black and white attached to the contract, or else we're dead in the water, because he says, I'm using his words, the work instructions attached to the agreement are meaningless. So we have to get our agreement. We say, all right, based on what you're telling us, that this is not a big deal, and that you just found out about it, go try to rework them, and we'll work with you here. We did that, Your Honor. And the judge, with a bright blue line, says, and I asked him, I told the judge in the pretrial conference, Judge, if we had known about that, after all of our due diligence, after what we bought, that this company tells us we've got meaningless work instructions, and that they've known about the unavailability for months, and that their head ceramist says, it's my worst nightmare, it would have been a showstopper. We would have said, please leave. This contract's over. Because you're right, they are meaningless in the light of that. This jury got such a small snapshot of what was going on here. And the judge was so concerned that I was trying to run afoul of his summary judgment order. And I said, Judge, this is a modification theory which they're advancing. We have to assent to that modification. We have to assent to them changing this work instructions. And we did, arguably, but without the truth. And I can't cross-examine this man on that issue. I also was not allowed to cross-examine him as to his credibility. Why did you say it then? Why did you say it again later in September in the letter? And why did you say it again in November? He said it because he needed to appease us. He needed to keep us at bay, that this was just some freak occurrence. All right. Your Honor, on the Rule 50 motion. Okay, I'll save some time. On the Rule 50 motion and on the fraud. Basically, our briefs cover the fraud. There should not be a per se rule with a non-disclosure agreement and an integration clause. This is the perfect case where our fraud claims pursuant to the summary judgment order should have been allowed to go to the jury. There is all the elements that the First Circuit set forth, which should be guidance to this court, that a per se rule is not it should not be the law. And in terms of the Rule 50, Your Honor, there was no evidence that they reached verification. They admitted they didn't. And there was no evidence that the royalty is due because of the fact that the final product just happened to match the specifications. They completely failed to put on any evidence that it was derived from that technology or the patents.
I'd like to just step back for a moment, talk about the case as a whole. This is a remarkably simple case on the facts from our point of view, and that is that Wright bought something from Cerebio. It didn't pay for it. Its only excuse was that there was a delay in going to market with this product due to the unavailability of the TCP powder. Its vice president, however, and its project manager admitted that delay was not Cerebio's fault. Yes. Could they have done that? Yes, it would have required, though, the events in August to have gone forward with Wright's involvement, which was going back to Plasma Biotone and saying, we'd like to buy some more of this powder, we want to test it out. That's when the issue about the unavailability of the same powder arose. But, yes, certainly... either until the closing or until the contract was signed. That is certainly true, Your Honor. Yes. Well, this is a very substantial multinational company, and we're talking about a commodity. It's not really a commodity. We're talking about a chemical that is well understood and that other people in the industry utilize. So I would assume that they could have done due diligence on a parallel track. Right. Well, it has to work that way. It has to work that way in this case because, you see, Wright at the same time was trying to develop this very product on their own independently. At the same time, they're negotiating with our clients. So I think everyone agreed that it was an appropriate contract provision. Right. No, they could have reversed and they could have reverse engineered it. That is a possibility. Two things, though, Your Honor. First of all, they bought the patent. They're using the patent. So whatever else, they're using the patent that they bought, they ought to pay for it. But secondly, and this is vitally important, I think, the concept that they reverse engineered and developed on their own a different way to do this is completely inaccurate. The record is absolutely clear on this, that there are four essential elements to the patented process that Cerebio developed. The first is the use of the TCP powder in a thick solution. The second is the repeated squeezing. The third is the drying of the powder, burning it out. And the fourth is the use of an alpha-beta combination. Nobody else had that. It was unique. Nobody else had that. It was patented. These are undisputed facts. Ms. Burgess and Mr. Bays admitted at trial that each of these four elements was part of their process. And I'll say furthermore, Ms. Burgess admitted in cross-examination that although she had a long list of all the differences in the process at trial, that she had said in her deposition that there were only small differences in the process. I believe when the jury heard that the credibility of Cerebio's entire presentation was put in great doubt, and that influenced the jury determination. So we have the same process, we have the same end product, we have them using the animal tests for appetite for Cellplex, which, I mean, that would have been a very wrong thing to do if they weren't an identical product. We have them telling the FDA, in their filings of the FDA, that these products are identical to appetite. So I think that remember the standard is they don't have to be exactly the same. They merely have to be derived from or incorporate some of the transfer technology. They certainly started with the transfer technology. How many little changes they made is debatable, but I don't think it really matters. No, it did not. And I'd like to address that as a factual issue, Your Honor, because I don't think Mr. Taylor got the facts right there. In the due diligence, there was Mr. Smith and Mr. Joynes who were in this one-day meeting, and Mr. Joynes says, well, they told me we had numerous backup products, and this would not be a problem, and that was the basis of the fraud claim. His testimony alone. But his colleague, Mr. Smith, in the same meeting said, no, we were told that for the TCP powder there was only one source, which is true. Everyone knows that's true. That they hadn't bought from that source in a couple of years, true. And they'd have to revalidate the process with that source, true. And in fact, that's when the problems came out during that revalidation process. So I respectfully submit that the probative value of the fraud claim is very, very much in doubt. And in fact, under the clear and convincing evidence standard in Wisconsin, I think there's a substantial argument as a matter of law that when you've got the only two witnesses to this event and they contradict each other, that the jury could never believe to the clear and convincing evidence standard the testimony of the one and not the other. In August, Sarah Bio, yes, the evidence is that, now this is August now, pre-closing, just before the closing. Sarah Bio learns that Plasma Biotol has two powders. One is the old powder, but it's contaminated. The current supply is contaminated, not usable. The other is the new powder that Plasma Biotol has developed, which is untested and ultimately turns out to not work. At that time, yes, Dr. Coe says this is his worst nightmare. And he says that to Plasma Biotol. But what Mr. Taylor didn't tell the court, and he didn't put in his briefs, is that Plasma Biotol wrote back to Dr. Coe after he says, this is my worst nightmare, and says, don't worry, we can get you the old powder. That's the August 7th email. That's an incredibly important fact in this case, which you won't find in counsel's briefs, and which raises a serious question whether there's any real issue of fraud in this situation, not to mention the fact that, remember, now we're talking about did Sarah Bio have an obligation to the contract or under fraud? Sorry. Well, the jury shouldn't have heard all of that because the only purpose to be served by this exploration of these facts is to show that Sarah Bio is a bad guy, because it doesn't really go to the issue of the breach of the contract. And again, I come back to the simple fact, if they got what they ordered and didn't pay for it, and their only excuse is this a problem, the delay in the powder, and they admit that that's not Sarah Bio's fault, and as Your Honor pointed out earlier in a question, it's not in the contract that it's Sarah Bio's obligation, and then there's no guarantee that they're going to be able to go to market at any particular time. Under those circumstances, I think the jury is never going to find that Sarah Bio materially breached this contract. Why should Wright get out of paying for what it bought? I think there's a couple really important points there as well, Your Honor. The quote issue of oral modification of the contract, in our viewpoint, was never a legal issue. It's not in the special verdict. We never raised it as a legal issue. We didn't think we needed to prove there was an oral modification. If that was an issue, we would have argued, for example, that changing the directions in the back of the book a little bit, that's not a That's not a modification of a contract. That is, I mean, you know, these things have to be flexible. Those would have been the kind of issues. But we didn't need to reach that point in our case, and the judge did not submit a special verdict question because it's the only way Serbrow is liable is for a material breach. Under all these circumstances, it did not materially breach the contract. As far as Judge Shabazz and the bright blue line, if this was a case where he drew a bright blue line and then they came in and said, we want to put in this evidence, and he says, I'm not even going to listen to you because I've drawn my line, I'm not going to say the argument, it would be a very different case. But he drew his line here after he considered all of these things. And the question is, did he do so in a way that was arbitrary? And we would submit he did not, because he engaged in the normal process a district judge should, considering and evaluating and giving reasons for what he did. And he found, I think it's critical to note, he found that he believed the purpose, that Wright's purpose in trying to introduce the evidence was to impermissibly get into the fraud issues. In fact, he referred to their brief in somewhat disparaging terms because I think he felt that it wasn't really fully candid about why they wanted to do this. And he expressed his deep concern about getting into a situation where the door would be open and the case swallowed up by this collateral inquiry, and for very good reason, because if you read Wright's brief and you go through the list of all the things they wanted to put into evidence, it's basically everything that happened in the relationship from the first time they met, involving a different contract, all the way up to the date the contract was signed. The list is almost endless of the things that they wanted to get in. So Judge Shabazz not only was reasonably concerned, but I think he was right in deciding that what this is really about is an effort to get into the impermissible area, and not really a concern about getting in evidence on the contract. And even if there was some issue there, that in the balance of things, it really clearly comes down in favor of excluding this kind of evidence. And I might add just briefly on that, of course, in any analysis, you look at the probative value of the evidence. Isn't it interesting, again, that counsel in his briefs never quoted this letter, which is the whole basis of the appeal here, on the exclusion of evidence. He never quoted this letter with the supposed lie of Mr. Cassidy. And when you read it in context and then you realize that Plasma Biotol on August 7th had told Serbrow, we can get you the old powder, that it isn't a lie at all. Or if it is some sort of a lie, it is one to which there is significant evidence to show that it is not of material importance, because Serbrow acted honorably. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. So the probative value of this evidence, how is it going to change the outcome of the trial, is I think, very dubious. Yes. Yes. Correct. I don't think it's in the record. I think it's not in the record. It was discussed at the pretrial, but not made a part of the record. I think the important point there, this was, I don't believe it was, we couldn't find it, okay? However, I just don't know, Your Honor. We couldn't find it, we looked for it, we couldn't find it. I think the important thing is that at the close of our case, I said to the court that I'm closing subject to evidence from Mr. Bays and Ms. Burgess, and no one said, I object, or you can't do that, or anything else. And so that fact, plus the fact that all of the documentary evidence and the depositions on which we relied were already a matter of record at that time in any event, leaves us with a record at that point, which I think is quite strong on that factual issue. Thank you.
I'll speak very quickly. Mr. Binder asked me, why didn't I use this letter? Well, I didn't have any punchline that I could go into by using this letter. with Mr. Cassidy on cross-examination. It was referred to, but I could not cross-examine him on the points I needed to elicit from him. That's why I didn't focus on that letter. As I said earlier, I would have said, Mr. Cassidy, you make a big point how this process to redo this would be no big deal and it's common in the ceramics industry. Why did your chief ceramist tell everyone it was going to be a nightmare and that I might have to wash off 3 years of effort? Those are the kind of things the jury was unable to hear. Mr. Binder talks about some letter August 7th about from Plasma Biotol, the sorcerer, saying that I can get you the powder. He doesn't say that. He said, I can get you a similar style powder. Well, we know that. That's what they were trying to do for 3 months unsuccessfully. That's a complete red herring. He said, well, I can get the old style powder, which is, and all of that testimony from, well, it is. I'm going to tell you why, because that's exactly what they were doing for 3 months. The old powder was a B series. He discontinued that. He said, I have a P series, which I think we can work with to do the same thing. Well, it took them 3 years to get the B series to work, and we know they were conducting science experiments on our property with the P series, the style of powder, and it didn't work. So it's a complete red herring, and it is a big difference, I suggest. This email came after the contract was signed. Your Honor, you asked a question, when did they first learn about the unavailability? And Mr. Binder said, just days before the contract. Well, that's not true. June 29th, 30th, July 1, July 2 were the key emails. That was a month and a week before the contract closed is when the sourcing powder said, quote, you often ask for what we don't have. And that's when those emails start to flow. They knew it well before the contract. Modification theory, they certainly presented it. He presented it as an opening argument. He presented it through Cassidy at Appendix 367, line 18 and 21. They were pushing this modification theory throughout their whole case, that the work instructions needed to be modified because of the newly discovered unavailability of the powder. It was a major theme of this case. The starting powder was a key issue in the whole case, and we couldn't get into the truth and what they knew about it and why they were so concerned about it. Thank you.